good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from Red River Radio, made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. We invite you to call in with your questions tonight about our feathered friends and avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press, and he has authored over 60 publications on birds. He and his wife, Julie, and their two children live in East Texas. Cliff, thanks for joining us tonight.
Hey, good evening.
All right. Now, we're going to start this month's program with our recap of last month's conservation tip. Can you tell us about that conservation tip?
Yeah, so it's for coffee drinkers, which is about half of us in the country or actually globally. And if we just did a different type of coffee that you really wouldn't taste the difference, you could be doing things for birds. And that's called shade-grown coffee, sometimes known as bird-friendly coffee. And what that means is, down in where they're growing the coffee, they're not removing all the native plants and the trees and such. They're just taking out some of it and growing the coffee beans and shrubs underneath the native plants, the native trees. So you leave some assemblage of the native cover, which a lot of the birds are using, versus clearing it all out and putting out coffee beans, and virtually no birds use that. It's almost a biological desert.
Yeah. So it's really almost like clearing the underbrush and using that space for the coffee plants, and maybe getting a little sunlight in there as well.
Getting a little sunlight, leaving the mature trees that were there, that a lot of our birds here in the Red River Radio listening area use in the winter. So it really does matter to us here in the U.S. for what's happening down in Latin America, because we have so many of our birds winter down there. So it would benefit us to do this, because we're benefiting the birds that come back and breed here. Lots of orioles, warblers, tanagers, buntings, vireos, things like that, that are migratory. And they spend the winter down in coffee plantations, but they come back up here either to migrate through here or stay here and breed. So it does benefit us as Americans, as Red River Radio listening area people too.
This week's program, you can call in at 800-552-8502 to talk to Cliff tonight about anything featured on our avian world. And we're going to start the show off this week with a brand new bit of sound, I guess. And this is for what bird? Do you want to hear the sound first?
Yeah, let's listen.
All right. And which bird is this?
This is the song of a very popular bird in our listening area. This is the eastern bluebird. And this is the song. It's the bluebird that most people are familiar with in the listening area. There are three species of bluebirds in North America. This one's the eastern bluebird that we have in the listening area. And it's got a kind of a whiny, kind of sounds like he's complaining. Oh, geez, Willie, oh, man, you. He's kind of got a whiny song to him. To me, it's not very musical, but it's very nice little song that I like to hear, because that tells me that that spring and breeding season's come, because right. These are one of the first of our passerines that starts to breed. They like cavities. They really like nest boxes. And so people can build nest boxes, put them up, that would benefit this bluebird. And I think that's maybe one of the reasons why bluebirds are doing so well. They're one of the few native birds that are on the increase. And it's possibly thanks to bluebird boxes, but I think it's certainly thanks to us creating openings when we put in homes, subdivisions, farmland, livestock, whatever. We're creating that open habitat that bluebirds like so much. We have some other vocalizations, don't we? Because
yes.
We have the call note, too. Right. Let's try that. Kind of a chua, chua.
And is this a stress call?
This is different context than song. You'll hear this a lot in year round, but more so in the winter. Well, actually, I should say you don't hear the song in the winter time as much. So you'll start hearing them sing in late February, early March. But this is a call note, so it's different context than the song. And then we have a third vocalization, the chatter, and it doesn't need any description.
What are they doing when we hear this?
And they're that's probably bickering, maybe male, female, or you'll hear them do that when there's a raptor around, when they're complaining. So that's the chatter call note. So we played three different vocalizations of the Eastern Bluebird. And I think what's really interesting is that there are so many bluebird societies. There's the North American Bluebird Society. There's a Texas Bluebird Society. There's a Louisiana Bayou Bluebird Society. And the neat thing is they have websites with lots of information, including blueprints. If you want to go out and build a bluebird box, you need to know the dimensions. You need to know how big the entrance hole should be, because they're kind of like Goldilocks. If it's too big, it's not right. If it's too tight of a hole, it's not right. And same thing with the dimensions of the box itself. It has to be just right for the bluebird to like it. And then there's other things you have to think about. Predator guards, because guess what? They're putting eggs and nestlings in that box that a lot of things want to eat. Mm-hmm. Rat snakes, raccoons, your backyard cat. So you want to make sure you put in predator guards to keep the predators away. And that's another good thing about those societies. They're really good about telling you everything you need to know. So you don't have to go and start from scratch. You can just pull up one of these websites for these bluebird societies and learn all the basics, and then try to apply that on your property. Now, if you have a completely wooded property, you're not going to have bluebirds. They need some openings. They really like edge. They like where woods meet the edge of an opening, like a field. And that's where you see a lot of the bluebird box trails, where people put them up on fence posts.
And are they mainly in the countryside, or do you see them in the city as well?
Well, both. I live very much in the city in Nacogdoches, and we have a resident pair. And actually, they built a nest in a box that a buddy, Greg Grant, put up for us, that he built for us. And the very first year, the bluebirds nested in there. And what's a lot of fun is there's so many other birds that want to use that same nest box. So the next year we had chickadees nesting in it, and that was a lot of fun. And then also there are things you don't want coming in there, like red wasps. So when you check your boxes, really check it from a distance first to make sure there are no red wasps in there. So what some people recommend is if you're trying to target bluebirds, but you have all these other things like titmice and chickadees wanting to use it, put up multiple boxes. Think of it like free government housing for everybody. So put up multiple boxes, because you might not realize where it should be, and the bluebirds are pretty particular. You know, they're checking out boxes like, this one's not right. It's not facing the right direction. Oh, this one's a little too tall. This one's too close to the woods. And so, again, back to Goldilocks, it needs to be just right. And that you can help by putting up multiple boxes, because maybe one of the three or four boxes you put up will suit them well and they'll use it. So I really like the bluebird. I'm impressed how many people love bluebirds. They're beautiful. There's no other bird that's so blue with a rusty underside. And when a male flies, it's just gorgeous. The female has the same color, but I like to tell people it's almost like she got a fresh coat of paint and then went to the car wash too soon. Mm-hmm. And the car wash kind of melted away the brightness. So she's still blue. It's just not as blue. She's still rusty red underneath, but not as rusty red underneath as the male. They're easy to tell apart the sexes by how bright and vibrant those colors are, the brighter one, of course, being the male.
Would you consider this a harbinger of spring coming?
Well, that usually refers to a migrant that all of a sudden shows up. You haven't seen it for months.
Right.
And so this bird stays with us year-round. Actually, we get more numbers in the winter of eastern bluebirds, and we see that on Christmas bird counts. You can see big flocks. I've had flocks before in the dozens. 30 to 70 is unusual, but I've seen it several times of just bluebirds. And probably a lot of them are coming down south in the wintertime. They may have bred in states farther to our north. And they acclimate pretty well. They're pretty hardy, and they eat a lot of berries and insects. So when the insects aren't flying, they might switch to berries that are available. They'll eat holly and mistletoe and poison ivy berries, if you can believe that. And just anything that's a berry, a lot of ilex, they like that too. They really like hackberry when they start putting fruit out. The sugar berry is another species in the genus Celtis they really like. So they're pretty omnivorous, and so that enables them to stick around when it's cold versus if you're strictly insectivorous like a lot of our flycatchers and vireos and warblers. They have to get out of here because once the temperatures get cold, it's tough for them. But the really neat thing about March, it's my favorite month to be in this area because so many of these birds are coming back and you haven't seen them. It's like the return of old friends. It's right. Like, all right, the northern Perula's back. And, oh, I hear a hooded warbler. And, oh, good, there's a yellow-throated vireo. And so it's really a neat time of the year to be out in the woods right now. So this week of March is when a lot of those birds I just mentioned start returning. And it's just a really neat time. I'd call those more of the harbingers of spring. Yeah.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give him a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502 with any question about birds tonight. If you have a photograph tonight and you'd like to send that in, you can send that in to rmoran@lsus.edu. That's rmoran@lsus.edu. .edu, and Cliff will try to identify that bird. And we've had a number of those photographs come in over the course of this show, and we're grateful for that. Now, I have a question. Spring migration season's beginning, or is it already underway? Where are we at in this?
It's already underway for a lot of things. Black and white warblers have been pushing through. Of course, purple martins have already made their mark. Not all of them are here, but a lot of them are here. And any day now, because March 17, 18 is usually the first arrival date for our ruby-throated hummingbird in my area. So we should be able to see a ruby throat any minute. I mean, not just any day, but maybe any minute.
So now is a good time to get up a feeder if you want to help them out as they travel along.
Now's a good time to put your feeder out. If you've had it stowed away for the winter, it's time to get your recipe back going. That's four parts water boiled with one part table sugar, not any other kind of sweetener. Not honey, not the pink stuff, not the yellow packets, just table sugar. It's real easy. Boil that together, of course, let it cool, and then fill the feeder up, and here come the ruby-throated hummingbirds.
Yeah, natural birds don't need a diet plan.
So. That's right. And another thing we recommend for the hummingbirds is put a wildscape in your yard, and that means planting nectar-giving plants for wildlife, specifically for, in this case, for hummingbirds, butterflies, and other pollinators that are looking for nectar.
Can give us a quick list of two or three of those that folks can go out and invest in if they want to put up some plants.
Yeah, some real easy ones that work in our area with our climate. Any of the salvias, Turk's cap, the native lantana, coral bean, those are just a few that really are favored. They bring in color. And in your backyard, it's exciting to have that kind of color, and knowing that it's not only color, but it's providing something to wildlife versus if you just have, you know, green monkey grass and green nandinas and green vincas. These things are, they're green if you like an English garden, but it has no value. Those species have no value to wildlife, right, especially these birds. They're looking for something much more. So give them something native. Give them something that gives back to them. Don't just put up a feeder. Plant some these natives that I mentioned that will attract these individuals.
And natural nectar, I would presume, is dietarily better.
Overall. And for hummingbirds, about 10 to 12% of their diet is going to be protein. They can't survive on that nectar. So about 88, 90% roughly of their diet is nectar. It's carbohydrate-rich sucrose. And that's not 100% of their diet. They still need protein to build muscle. And so they'll eat a lot of gnats, little insects. They probably eat some mosquitoes, too, because they're bite-sized. And you'll see hummingbirds do that when all of a sudden he just looks like he's hovering in one spot. But if you get your binoculars on him, his beak is opening and closing, and he's snapping, and he's grabbing little nuggets of gnats. It's like a Cheeto, 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 Cheeto.
You're listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. We have a full boat of calls. Joy, Michael, and Kenneth, you're online. Please hang on. Right now we're going to go to Stacy from Shreveport. Stacy, you're on with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Yes, my question is, I'm not sure what bird it is that walks through every year in January and eats all the holly berries off the holly trees. It seems like it happens in a day, but they didn't come this year. And I was wondering, did they just not come to my yard, or or was there some reason that they didn't arrive this January?
Yeah, there's two species that do that. The American robin, I think most people are familiar with, and the other one is the cedar waxwing. And if you ever see one, you'll never see a feather out of place. They're very silky smooth with a little top notch or crest. And both of those birds will just, in big numbers, just descend on a berry bush and strip it. And guess what? That berry bush isn't going to have berries available till another year. So they're nomadic. And so I think what we're going to see is these birds are finally going to get to our area sometime. We'll sometimes see cedar waxwings come through late-ish in the year. So I think you might be, if you're patient, you might be rewarded. I think they're still on their way.
Okay, great. Yeah. I always love seeing them come in.
Yeah, and look up cedar waxwing. That's probably your bird. If not, then it's American robin. Those are the two birds that do what you described.
Okay, thanks
yeah.
so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for your call. You're listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. Joy is next online. Joy, what's your question tonight?
Well, I really had two questions. My first question is, this last winter, I guess maybe from September until right now, we really have hardly any birds at all come to our feeder. I live in Tennehaw, Texas. I live in a real wooded area. And the winter before that, we had so many cardinals especially. And I'm noticing this winter they were very, very sparse. I was disappointed. But now they're starting to come back. I'm seeing a few cardinals and a few maybe little chickadees, those little bitty birds that come to our feeder. And I was wondering what happened to all those birds this last winter.
Okay, that was a dominant call that I got at my desk and also email this year in our area. And what we saw, in my opinion, these birds are not gone. The sky is not falling. What happened was we got a very wet year in 2014, and Mother Nature provided a lot of food. And what we put in our feeder is like fast food that you get tired of pretty darn quick, and you'd rather have home cooking. So Mother Nature's providing the home cooking, and we're providing the junk food. And so the junk food is there when they really need it. Just remember, it's supplemental. So we have a problem of gauging bird activity by how used the feeder is, and that's not really safe. Because what I found is I just would walk in the woods and I'd find those cardinals and all those other feeder birds. They were just eating stuff that Mother Nature was providing. They didn't want to go to that feeder. So all those birds you're seeing coming back, they probably exhausted everything out there that Mother Nature's provided. And so that feeder is going to get them through till the new growth comes. But I don't believe in the skies falling. When people said that there weren't any birds at their feeder, and that, you know, there's a lot of birds that don't come all the way down here in big numbers, like pine siskins. But when they start saying we don't have any cardinals, and I thought, you know, I see 7 or 8 cardinals on every little walk I go on. They're just not hovering around the feeder. So they're still here. They were just eating that good home cooking.
Well, that was my second question. What do you recommend for the birds? What do you recommend for us putting our feeder?
Well, I recommend if you got to do a feeder, I mean, you can't go wrong with black oil sunflower. You want to make sure you keep raccoons, squirrels, and other cheats away, because they'll eat it up in a hurry. So you want to get a predator guard to keep those guys off, a squirrel guard. But I really recommend, going back to what I said a minute ago for hummingbirds, is putting in a wildscape. So put in that Mother Nature gourmet dinner that these cardinals and other backyard birds will eat. Don't let them heavily rely on your feeder, and you'll be rewarded, because this was a year not to watch your feeder.
Okay, so yep. I shop at the Wild Bird store in Shreveport. They're very, very nice and helpful. And I buy really, really expensive bird food, mainly because I buy the food that's already been shelled, so it's not wasteless. But they have all that black oil sunflower seed in there. It's just not black. It's orange.
Right.
But, okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your answer.
Thank you, Joy. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Joy. And you are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio. And our resident ornithologist is Cliff Shackelford. You can reach us at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we're going to go next to Michael from Bossier City. You're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've got two quick questions. A couple of nights ago, I had what I think is a mockingbird outside my window who was very awake. And I started counting his patterns, and I think I got north of 40, and I never heard a repeat. How many patterns do they do? Was that rare? And the second thing is, I fish on a little cypress lake, and somebody has put bluebird boxes all over the cypress trees, all out over the water. Is that... Do they nest there?
That's a good question. The latter question is a good one. I don't know that I've seen bluebirds nesting over water, but they'll be, I'm sure, the titmice and the chickadees will use it. You'll see sometimes woodpeckers will come in and make some renovations and drill around the hole and make it a little bigger so they can use it. So actually, I'd be curious, and maybe this will give you an excuse to go fishing more often, because I'm going to give you a homework assignment. Why don't you call us back in a few months and tell us what you see using those boxes? Because you've got me curious about what's going to use those boxes over water. So your mockingbird singing at night, it's believed that those are unmated males. So think of a lonely male that has no girlfriend, and he's putting into overdrive the singing so he can hopefully attract a mate. So you asked about the patterns. Yeah, I don't know the answer. Older mockingbirds, because a lot of it's of course learned behavior. An older mockingbird is going to have a bigger repertoire than a younger mockingbird. You might just have an old male who's single all of a sudden and he's got quite a repertoire. So I don't know the answer. I've heard that they can, I've personally heard them imitate at least 30 plus different things. And I say things because it's not just birds. They'll imitate kind of the cries of a cat. They'll do car alarms. They'll do squeaky gates. One of the best ones I ever heard was actually at one of the drop-offs at Intercontinental Airport in Houston. And that mockingbird got such a resonance under that, such an echoey resonance under that drop-off. It was just like it was amplified. And he was just going on. I could hear, okay, did red-bellied woodpecker. And then he switched right to tufted titmouse. And, you know, you're listening to him, you're like, oh, listen, he's doing a blue jay. And it's a lot of fun. So the neat thing to do is try to record it, because then you can go through it over and over. And that's what the people that study mockingbirds do, so they can test it in the lab and figure out how many different species. But I don't know the exact answer. I think it just varies with the age of the bird and what's his experience level and what has he heard. So I would say over 30 species. And so your other homework assignment, Michael, is to listen to the mockingbird and maybe record them and see if you can tell us a number of how many different vocalizations you've heard that one do.
I think I would rather just get this one a girlfriend.
I'm right there with you, Michael. I got one outside of my window, too.
Yeah, Bill was talking about his earlier. So we need to get a match.com for mockingbirds. Yep, that's funny. But you do like the other homework assignment that requires you do more fishing, I hope. That one's okay, right?
That's right. I appreciate it.
And all if right, you can, you. Michael, get some pictures. We'd love to see your photos if you get them.
All right. I'll see what I can do.
All right. Thank you, Michael. And you are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. We got a full bank of phones right now. Kenneth from Hale, Louisiana, you are next. And what's your question for Cliff?
Well, I got some info about your bluebirds.
Oh.
I got a father-in-law that lives in Hale, and he builds bluebird houses.
Okay.
His name is Jimmy Dean.
Jimmy Dean, like the sausage.
Mm-hmm. Right, and they can look him up in the Marion phone book if they want to buy houses.
Okay.
And he's got, I think he's got over 2,000 houses out around Marion and Hale and down in there for Bluebirds.
So he knows what he's doing.
Yep, he's head of one of the Bluebird organizations down there.
Okay, very good. Well, thanks for the tip on that.
And if somebody have an organization they want to have them come out and speak, they'd be more than welcome to do it.
Okay, thanks for the tip. So I'm sure he tells people that Bluebirds are not included with the sale of a box, right?
Well, he goes to he does a lot of Boy Scout stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
And if he goes to a meeting like that, he finds out how many kids is going to be in there, and he'll build them all a Bluebird box to take home with them.
And he brings the kit, and they have to assemble it later?
No, it's already put
together. Oh, and so they just have to put it up.
It depends on the leader, how they want it, if they want a kit or the house.
Yeah, yeah.
But normally he puts them together, and all they got to do is hang it.
Wow, now that's what I call a good activity in retirement is to do this something like this where it's good for kids, it's good for wildlife, man. It's a win-win all the way around. So kudos to who did you say this is, your father-in-law?
My father-in-law, Jimmy Dean.
Yeah, Jimmy Dean. Okay, easy to remember. Sausage and Bluebirds.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. He's in the Marion phone book.
Great. Hey, thanks for the call, Kenneth.
You bet. Y'all have a great day.
Thank you.
Nothing like quite like getting the grandpas and the grandkids together, is there? Give us a call at 800-552-8502 if you'd like to talk to Cliff tonight. He is our resident ornithologist and is the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And he is with us until 7 o'clock tonight. Our next caller is going to be Otis. And Otis, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
About 3 years ago, it was early in the spring, and birds, bluebirds and other birds, chickadees, were checking out boxes. And the chickadees had been there the year before and nested in this box. And I saw them, they weren't refurbishing the nest or anything. But I realized that I had not cleaned it out, and I said, I better get busy and clean this thing out. Well, the next day, they met me as soon as I came out of the house, and they were in my face for about 2 days, about as close as 8 or 10 feet away, and they were really giving me a good chewing out. So my question is, what birds should I clean the nest out of the box every year, and which one should I leave alone?
I would recommend cleaning them all out, because a big part of nesting for birds is the pair bonding that happens during the act of the nest building, bringing in the twigs, the rootlets, the leaves and the grass and so forth to weave together to make the soft part of the nest where they lay the egg. So I would say clean all that out, because there are some groups that will tell you it could get infested with mites, and to get rid of it. So you want to do the cleaning in the late summer, early fall, and then you don't have to worry about it, because there's nothing in there to really host any pests or other arthropods that might be a problem.
Okay, because these guys have not been back.
Yeah, well,
they gave me a good chewing out. About 2 days, and they left and never came back.
Yeah, well, and I see a lot of birds inspect cavities, either natural cavities or nest boxes, and they don't like something, because they'll check it out, and you'll think, all right, they're going to nest, and that's it. They don't come back. And I think if you remember when you bought your first house, you probably, like me, you drove around and you looked at several houses before you bought one, and there's just something about curb appeal, maybe. And I don't know what all birds look at when they look at these cavities, but that doesn't mean that they're going to use it. Just because we put it up doesn't mean it's going to get used, especially by something we're targeting. We'll see a lot of people put up a bluebird box, and man, they get upset when the chickadee moves. And I'm thinking, the chickadee is just like the bluebird. He needs a cavity but he doesn't have the bill to excavate like a woodpecker, so he relies on old wood rot or an old abandoned woodpecker cavity, and so he's looking for the same real estate as that bluebird. And I'll tell you, I think a baby chickadee is about the cutest thing you've ever seen. They look like they're in little tuxedos. So I think if you're targeting one specific thing, you can get into a lot of disappointment. I think if you just put it up and say, I'm going to get some kind of cavity nesting bird, that means you're not going to get red wafts. You know, but nobody wishes for that. But I think if you just open up your horizons, you'll be rewarded a lot more than if you're just targeting one thing, because you might not get it. A lot of people put up wood duck boxes, and I saw one guy complain that an eastern screech owl moved in, and I thought, that is, I think, much cooler than having a wood duck. So cool to open up, and there's a sleeping screech owl in there. And so I think if you want to have wood ducks and screech owls, put up multiple boxes. Again, put up free government housing for everybody. But just keep in mind that not everybody's using the same size box. There's several different box sizes, length, width, et cetera, and especially diameter. So don't expect a big bird to get into a little box and vice versa. Don't think that a little bird's going to want a big box, because they don't. They want it to fit their size. So put up multiple size boxes and see what comes in. You might get rewarded. In our area, we might get a great crested flycatcher. That's one that's really neat to get in a box that you might have put up for something else.
Yeah. Well, one year, when the chickadees were fledging, one of them ended up on the ground about 10 feet from the nest box. And my golden yellow retriever went over to check it out, and this little chickadee bowed up at him, and he faced him off. and I caught him. It was and put him back in the box.
Yeah.
And I assume that Mama came looking for him, but I don't know.
Yeah, and that's a good thing, because, you know, when they're ready to fledge, they're ready to fledge. But there's a time where they're almost ready to fledge that the babies are all up at the box trying to get that good position to get the food from mom or dad when they come in, and sibling accidentally pushes you out, and you'll see that on occasion, and that might be a day or two or more too soon for fledging, and but there's probably some benefit to that. Think about it. A lot of birds have more nestlings than they really expect to raise to maturity, and that's kind of a little insurance, because just because they lay four eggs doesn't mean all four are going to make it to adulthood. And actually, the number's really low on how many eggs make it to their first year or even make it to fledging. It's pretty surprising. So I think if a bird can just replace itself at least once in that breeding season, they're in good shape.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Otis.
All right, thank you. You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, who is with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Service, the non-game ornithologist for them. You can give them a call right now at 800-552-8502. Phone lines are open. That's 800-552-8502. If you have a photo of a bird, please send it in at rmoran@lsus.edu. That's rmoran@lsus.edu. We're going to go to Mary from Nacogdoches. Mary, you're online next. What's your question?
Well, hello. I live 18 miles east of Nacogdoches near the Scenic Overlook. I've been there 23 years. And on March 9th, it rained all day. We had many hundreds of robins visit our woods from 10 a.m. till noon. And I've seen them many times pass through here during the season, but never at this quantity and never to last for 2 hours in the woods here. I would watch what they're doing, and there must be something good. All I can see is that we have lots and lots of yaupon. Do they eat yaupon?
Yeah, they'll strip berries. They'll also feed on the ground. They'll scratch the leaf litter like a chicken will, and eat things that are in the leaf litter in the woods. They can do both of those. And if you had hundreds of them, they probably drain the resource pretty darn quick.
No, we have lots of yaupon, and we have a large acreage. We're And so I couldn't see him pick any berries, and I still have lots of berries around. But we have high woods and just lots of food for them. I didn't know if that's what they were doing. I would try to watch one, and it was raining. They would fly to another tree, and they'd go up in the pine, and they'd pick on a tree. They were just, the more I looked, the more you'd see, you know, every tree was just full of them.
Yeah.
It was like the birds from Alfred Hitchcock.
Well,
it was noise, too, with the rain.
It
was a hard raining day. That was March 9th from 10 to noon, because I even wrote a poem about it. It was so unusual. I've seen them many years. But they stayed so long and were so loud, and then the rain on top of it. I was almost going to
That's neat.
That.
And then the rain might have changed their behavior such that they were kind of waiting out the rain, not acting, you know, maybe not feeding or acting normal. They were just, you know, taking a little bath. A lot of birds will bathe in the rain. It's a good excuse to clean off your feathers. But that could have been it. The rain maybe made them act a little differently. Maybe that's why you didn't see them eating any berries. Maybe they'd already eaten their fill, or they couldn't eat in the rain. So the rain definitely goofs things up.
Kind of addressing the former call, you know, when you said robins may not wait, because they were here. I mean, that was the first big group of robins I saw, and then they went off towards center. Slowly, you could hear the noise slowly move off, you know, but it was just many hundreds, and we have robins every year, but not in that number, and not for 2 hours,
right,
in the same place, just squawking and flying and having a good time. So I just want to let you know the robins have shown up in force at my house.
Oh, good. Okay. Good. Thank you, Mary.
Thank you very much, Mary, for that call. You are listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist. You can call in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We're going to go next to Robert from Alexandria. Robert, what's your question for Cliff tonight? Hello,
hi,
Robert.
Hi, Cliff.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
So, enjoy the show. This is kind of an odd question.
Okay.
But maybe it's a good one to end the show on. I don't know. So, I was noticing a woodpecker really going at a telephone pole the other day, and the thought occurred to me is that that's a tremendous amount of force, and why don't they get concussions? Why don't woodpeckers get concussions?
That's a good question. They have specialized equipment for that. They've got a thicker skull than most birds. They've got specialized muscles in the neck that act as a shock absorber. And they have very powerful bills that have what's called a rhamphotheca. It's a bony sheath that's on the outer. It's kind of like a fingernail. It's ever growing, and so it can whittle down, and it replaces itself just like your fingernails and our hair. But if you see them rapping or drumming on a telephone pole, they're sometimes not excavating. They're not making a hollow. What they're doing is trying to make a loud drumming sound, and that's the equivalent of a songbird singing. It's a male telling other males, this area is occupied, there's no vacancy, keep out. So that's what you'll see them do, that on metal, like they'll do it on my gutters. I've heard them on metal roofs. We have a bird box. We talked about bird boxes. We have one that's up on a tree, and the red-bellied woodpeckers love to drum on that, and it really resonates like he's amplified. And so he's telling birds of his kind even farther away that, hey, this is my territory. Keep out.
All right, Robert? All right, thank you for calling, Robert. And that brings up, because when I lived in Florida for a long time, I had one out there, and he was banging on a metal pole, and it was driving me crazy, but now I know what he was doing.
Yep.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. We do have phone lines open right now, 800-552-8502. Or if you'd like, you can email a question or a photograph to rmoran@lsus.edu. That's rmoran@lsus.edu. And we're going to go next to John from Shreveport. John, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi, Dr. Shackelford. My name is John, and John McBride. And I was calling to let you know that the reason that there are bluebird houses out there in the cypress trees on the lake is that we have the Prothonotaria warbler.
Okay.
A lot of people put up the boxes for Prothonotaria warblers, and you mentioned something about birds needing different size houses.
Uh-huh.
And I have a publication at home called Woodworking for Wildlife from the Minnesota DNR.
Oh, yep.
And it gives different hole sizes. And I was wondering if Texas had a publication like that, if Texas Parks and Wildlife had a publication like that telling how to build the proper size so that you could select what birds.
Right. And I'm glad you called to remind me about the Prothonotary. I didn't know people were putting up that many boxes for that bird. That's cool. But we don't have that book. And did you say you authored it?
No.
Okay. You have it. Well, what I do, I love that book. And so there's no point in Texas reinventing the wheel. So time and time again, I have recommended that same book from Minnesota that you mentioned because it's fantastic. It's got a blue cover. It's spiral bound. At least my version is. And it has all the blueprints for varieties of birds. And so it is fantastic. And I'm glad you mentioned the Prothonotary warbler. That's one of only two warblers in North America that use cavities for nesting. The other one is the Lucy's warbler that's out west in the southwest, desert southwest. So we won't have that in the listening area. But you're right, Prothonotary warblers, and they'll be back any day. And they're nesting in cavities in swampy areas. And that's fantastic that someone's putting up boxes for them. For Prothonotaries, because that's a bright golden bird that is really fantastic to watch and listen to, and I'm glad somebody's putting those boxes up for them. So the next question would be, is it working? So we've got our angler friend. His homework assignment is to go look to see if those boxes are being used.
Yes, sir.
So, John, thanks for that. So what else have you used that that Minnesota book for building? What else have you used?
I use it for in my yard is for bluebird houses, but I don't build them myself. But it's a great reference, and I get my houses already built, and I've had chickadee and woodpecker, uh-huh. not woodpecker, chickadee and bluebirds,
uh-huh.
And then I even had a bluebird egg one year in January.
Cool, very cool. Okay, well, very good. Well, so if people are interested in Prothonotary warblers, you want to make sure you've got the right environment. You don't just put that up in a normal backyard. So you kind of want to have a slough or a swamp or back up to Red River National Wildlife Refuge, something like that, where you've got some habitat for them. Caddo Lake, if you've ever been to Caddo Lake, just think of Caddo Lake. That is perfect Prothonotary habitat. They are the mother load of Prothonotaries are up there at Caddo Lake, and more so on the Texas side where it's not the open water, it's the slough and the channels and Spanish moss and cypress, and inaccessible by land, but very accessible by canoe or kayak. That's what Prothonotaries like.
Yes, sir. Do you find?
Yep, we lost that one. All right, we lost that one. You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give a call right now at 800-552-8502 if you'd like to ask Cliff a question. We have all phone lines open right now. That's 800-552-8502. So I have a question from my youth. When I grew up up north, snows would come, all the robins would go away, and then in the springtime, we'd always go out and look for robins, building a nest to see if the winter was actually leaving. And we were always told, don't touch the nest, don't touch the eggs, and don't touch the chicks, because the human scent might, cause the mother to actually abandon or talk. Is that myth or fact?
It was a good thing for mom and dad to tell you because it probably worked, but it's mostly incorrect. Bird olfaction or sense of smell is very low in most birds. It's high in things like turkey vulture and some of the seabirds. But for your cardinal, and you mentioned the robin, they don't really use sense of smell. The point was just to stay back.
Right.
And the adult might be watching you, even though you don't see it, it might be watching you. And it's just not a good idea. So, yeah, I don't know that I would tell my kids that the parent birds would smell you, but I would just say, this is a fragile time.
Right.
The egg is fragile. The nestlings are fragile. They're scared of us. We look like jolly green giants or Godzilla. Just leave them alone. And I think that's the point that, that the parents are trying to make by keeping the kids out of there. And I wanted to mention to John, he brought up some good points. We lost you on the line. John, you can always call back because I think you had one more point. So feel free to call back for that final comment that you had.
And that number is 800-552-8502 if you are listening. Give us a call right now if you'd like to get on the line with Cliff Shackelford. All of our lines are open. The program is Bird Calls, and Cliff is our resident ornithologist. He is also the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. He's here tonight to answer your questions about birding and birds, and I'm going to go on to another question here. Right now is migratory season. What's the best place if I wanted to go out and really see a lot of migratory birds? Where would I go? Wetlands area, wooded areas?
In my area, the best migrant trap after rainstorm in later in the spring is going to be Pecan Park. It's a grove of pecan trees. It's, I think, 18 or 20 acres in size. But the main thing is it abuts Lenana Creek. And I think these creeks and rivers are really the thoroughfares. So if you've got any kind of woodlot, forest, big forest, big woods along a river, is going to be your best bet. So I would stay away from open pine stand or regenerating pine plantation. There are going to be a lot of breeding birds in there, but if you're asking about where to go to see migrants, those birds that aren't going to stick around, I would look for those bigger woods. Another place in my area is a spot called Saints Rest Road. It's the old railroad tram that went down to the Angelina River south of Nacogdoches, and that cuts through some big bottomland hardwood forests, and it can be fantastic. And I think every community has a what we call a migrant trap or a hot spot, and I don't claim to know every one of those. And the neat thing is you can try to find it yourself. You can go out and explore, and from what I've just described, maybe find that grove of trees and go looking for migrants. And a lot of it is not just looking, but listening, because a lot of these birds are singing, and that's how you can find Perulas and northern Perula and maybe black and white warbler and blue-gray gnatcatch right now is because they're vocalizing. Because these are tiny little birds, and they might be 80 feet up, and they're really difficult to see. So use your ears to try to help you find them. Later in the season, you'll have all kinds of other things singing. And a lot of the songsters don't even nest here. You'll hear yellow warblers, chestnut-sided warblers, Tennessee warblers, black-throated green warblers. None of those breed in Texas or Louisiana. Now, when you go up to the Wachitas and farther north into Ozark, some of those birds, like black-throated green, will start picking up as a breeder, and yellow warbler, but they're getting ready. They're pumping up those hormones, and they're singing even in transit, even in migration. So the point is listen, find the right habitat, and use your ears, and all that might come together. You might be really rewarded. So find that patch in your area.
You are listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist, and you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have Mark from Malmö, Louisiana on next. Mark, what's your question for Cliff?
Hey, how y'all doing today? I like the show, first time I've heard it.
Oh, great. Thanks for calling. Where's Malmö? I've never heard of that.
Malmö, it's south of west of Alexandria.
Okay.
30 miles.
Okay.
Down center state.
Yep. Great.
Yeah. My question is, there's a place that I fish around Malmö, and it's a farm area, about 200 acres or so, and it's got some small lakes on it. And every year I normally see a pair of ospreys come out there, and they stay during the summer. I think this year, in addition, there's a city lake that's close by, and I've seen a bald eagle there this year. Are they seasonal? Do they come in once a year and leave? Or, you know, I figured a pair of big birds like that would probably nest or hang around for a while.
Yeah, well, are you asking about the seasonality of the osprey or the eagle or both?
Both.
Okay, well, so the osprey, let's start with him. You're right, they're both big birds. They're both fish-eating birds. The osprey is here almost every month of the year. We don't go very far, even during the summer, where ospreys can't be lingering or hanging around or still migrating, but we have very few nesting records. So if you find an osprey nest, that's worth noting, taking pictures, et cetera. It doesn't mean it's never happened. It's just not very common. In Nacogdoches, there's a brand new, fairly new reservoir called Lake Nakanich, and there's a pair of osprey that have been nesting out there, and it's really cool. So there are not many nesting records of osprey in East Texas. So when you go to Florida, there's a buku of them. So I'm guessing for Louisiana, especially as far north as Alexandria or here in Shreveport, it would be probably noteworthy to take a picture of a nest of osprey. Now, bald eagle, we get a big influx of bald eagles in the wintertime. Starting in October, we get a lot of those northern birds that have to leave their homeland because everything freezes over. When you're a fish-eating bird and the pond and the lakes freeze, you're in trouble. So you come down south. So it's hard to know if your bald eagles are sticking around and breeding, but if they are, they're already over halfway done nesting. Because bald eagles start nesting very early in the calendar year when it's dead of winter. They're already building nests and laying eggs.
Okay. Well, I only witnessed one bald eagle. Didn't see mate to it. And also the osprey this year, I saw him Sunday, was by himself. And normally I think it was a female actually. But normally a pair hang around my pond and those ponds and fish.
Yeah, so my guess is you're probably going to lose both of those this summer. So when you go back out fishing in June, July, you probably aren't going to see the one of those, is my guess. But you could prove me wrong. That would be fun to find those. And you can't miss the nest. The bald eagle nest is, gosh, it's almost the size of a Volkswagen Beetle, made up of very large dead limbs, sticks, and so forth that are up in usually up in a pine tree, not always, but in our area they really like pine trees. And then the osprey is usually over water, and it's so that's why Nakanich, with its that it's fairly new, it's flooded a lot of timber. There's a lot of trees that are underwater that you know that are dead and dying, and they really like to put their nests in those, especially where the tree is topped, meaning it's broken off and there's no limbs and there's a big stump, and it's tall, so it might be 30, 50 feet up, and then they'll put their platform nest on top of that over water. Bald eagles don't have to nest over water. They can be, I've seen several bald eagle nests that are miles from water, but miles for a bald eagle to fly to water to the nest is nothing. It's like you going to the grocery store. It's no big deal.
And we have time for one more quick question. And Jay, you are live with Cliff. What's your question tonight, Jay?
Well, it's not actually a question. I wanted to remind him of the Birder's Guide to Louisiana that's been published by the American Birding Association. That's very useful for people wanting to know where to go in a particular area.
Yeah, Jay, that's very good. I'm guessing this is Jay Huner.
Yeah.
Okay, Jay, I'm glad you called and told us about that. And you're right, that is a good reference for people that are new to this. So do like Jay said and get a copy of this bird finding guide. In Texas, where I'm from, we have what's called the Wildlife Viewing Trail. It used to be called the Birding Trail. Same thing, but it's expanded more than just birding. But these are the hot spots that we're talking about. So as Jay mentioned, get a copy of this bird finding guide. It'll tell you where the hot spots are. Or in Texas, go online and look for the wildlife trails and try to find where those hot spots are. Some people have already done the homework, and all you have to do is just find out where these hot spots are and go visit them. So Jay, thanks for that reminder.
Thank you, everybody who has called in tonight. We appreciate it. And we're going to move on to our final little segment tonight in Cliff's conservation tip for the month. Can't say that. What is your conservation tip for this month?
This episode tip has to do with dead wood. Okay, the term dead wood in the workplace usually doesn't mean good things, but that same term in the outdoors can mean great things for a variety of wildlife. Let's run through a couple of definitions first. A snag is any standing dead tree, and once that snag falls to the ground, its name immediately changes to a log. So snags and logs are good for wildlife. A lot of folks in the listening area also use the word stob or stub, which they're usually referring to a dead limb in a live tree or the remnants of a dead tree peeking up above the water in a reservoir or pond. No matter where, though, dead wood can host a lot of living critters, especially birds. So when a tree in your yard dies and it must be removed because you're afraid it's going to fall on the house or the car or the playscape, consider leaving maybe 10 or 20 feet of the trunk intact for woodpeckers and other wildlife. This is good on your pocketbook too, because guess what? You're leaving the biggest, heaviest, thus most expensive part of removing the tree. So there are over 80 species of cavity-using birds in the U.S. Many of them are familiar to us in the Red River listening area, like various woodpeckers, eastern bluebird, which we highlighted at the beginning of this episode, wood ducks, Carolina chickadees, and several other species. So keep snags and logs intact on your property. Do it for the birds and other wildlife, and do it because it saves you money, and do it for your viewing enjoyment. And speaking of viewing enjoyment, a friend of mine, Corey Adams, and I put together a short 90-second video called There's Life in a Dead Tree. It's available on the Bird Calls page at redriverradio.org. And the star of that short video is a northern flicker. It's a type of woodpecker. And I filmed that in my backyard in Nacogdoches. And so enjoy the video. Again, it's found on the Bird Calls page at redriverradio.org. Leave dead wood standing.
And if you happen to be around Lake Nacogdoches down there, you might stop by the pavilion that some of our friends at the Timber Framers Guild put up about a little over a year ago. It was a wonderful project, and it's a great place to go with your family and enjoy yourself. Cliff, I want to thank you so much for joining me again for Bird Calls tonight.
Well, it just goes by too quick.
It does indeed. And we want to thank everybody who had called in tonight and helped us out with some really good questions. We really appreciate it. Next month, on the third Tuesday of the month, which will be the 21st, we will have What's Bugging You, and the next Bird Calls will be on May 19th. We hope you'll tune in for both of those shows right here from Red River Radio. You have been listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and he is from the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. He is their statewide non-game ornithologist, and we do want to thank everybody at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for all their help during this show. Cliff will be joining us joining us next time in May. This has been Bird Calls, and it's been produced by Cliff Shackelford and myself, Bill Beckett, with help from Wally Derleth, Renee Moran, and Henry Edwards. The audio for tonight's program will be posted to our website in the next few hours, so you can listen to the program again on redriverradio.org. And remember, if you have a photo or a sound clip of a bird that you would like Cliff to identify, you can send it to my email. That's wbeckett@lsus.edu. Again, that's wbeckett@lsus.edu. Again, I want to thank all the folks who called tonight. This is Bird Calls from Red River Radio, and we are your community-supported public broadcasting service from LSUS. This is KDAQ, Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA Alexandria-Pineville, KBSA El Dorado-Magnolia, and KLDN Lufkin-Nacogdoches. Stay tuned. Radio Lab is coming up next here from your public radio station, Red River Radio.